it onto the road and stepped over the tape and was standing behind me. The weeds around the body were stippled with blood. The ground smelled sour from either night damp or the blood that had seeped into the soil. The sun was hot on my neck.
"He's the guy who was in the accident with your wife,"
Labiche said. "That's him."
"Tough break."
"What's that mean?"
"It means I think the accident report sucked."
I stood up, my knees hurting. "I didn't hear you say anything about it at the time."
"I'm still a new guy. I don't express every opinion I might have."
He turned his head toward the convenience store.
"Here comes Queer Bait and the paramedics."
"What did you call him?"
"Nothing. It was a joke."
The coroner's name was Cormac Watts. He was a crew-cut, likable young guy from Virginia who wore seersucker pants high on his hips, long-sleeve white shirts, and a bow tie without a coat. He looked put together from sticks with snowshoes for feet. Cleet said Cormac made him think of a well-dressed scarecrow stepping over the rows in a tobacco field. Helen had been on her cell phone. She folded it and stuck it into her pocket. Her breasts swelled against her shirt when she took a breath. That was admissions at Iberia General. D'Artez's wife had to be sedated. The kids are with a social worker. "Who told her?" I asked. "Who knows? Maybe we have a witness. Get on it, will you, Spade?"
"You want me to go to Iberia General?"
"No. Go to the convenience store first. See if there are any witnesses. Then go to Iberia General."
"I'm assigned the case, though."
"That's not what's on my mind at the moment."
"Yes, ma'am. Look, I know y'all were a team. I'm not trying to bust up anything."
Helen's fists were propped on her hips. Her face pointed at the ground. "You did a good job. Call me from the hospital." She waited until Labiche was out of earshot. "I don't know if I want you on this one."
"You don't think I can be objective?"
She looked toward the convenience store and at Labiche walking to his car. She chewed her lip. "Did you do your drinking at home last night, or in a bar? Please tell me a bar."
"I didn't say I was drinking." "Get cute with me and I'll have you on the desk. Get cute with me twice and I'll have you on suspension."
"I don't know where I went last night or what I did." "Show me your hands." They're scraped. Her lips were crimped, her chest rising and falling. "I've beaten them against brick walls when I was drunk," I said. "It doesn't matter what the issue is. I always hurt myself.
And a few others. Shit!"
Cormac Watts walked toward us, the ambulance following him, the weeds whispering under the bumper. Helen turned her back to me. "What do you have, my favorite pathologist?" she said to him.
"The door was locked," Cormac said. "Somebody dragged him through the broken window, then went to work on him. I'd say he died of a broken neck and respiratory failure, or maybe massive cranial damage. I don't see any marks characteristic of a weapon, such as a hammer or a tire iron."
"You didn't bother to share that with Labiche?"
"I thought I'd save it for y'all."
"How long has the victim been dead?" she asked.
9 or 10 hours.
He paused and exhaled loudly. "What?" she said.
"The guy who did this must have been on meth. My guess is he did it with his bare hands. This is somebody who could eat his own pain while he flat tore somebody else apart. Know anybody like that around here?"
Chapter 7. I didn't go to a noon meeting. I went to the bank and applied for a loan against my house. My house was a humble one, built of cypress in the late 19th century, but the one-acre lot was located on one of the most scenic streets in the American South. I suspected the total value was around $600,000.
"How much do you need, Dave?" the banker asked.
"Around $250,000.
"It shouldn't be a problem. I'll send the appraiser out. You're not headed to Vegas, are you?"
In a roundabout way. He looked a bit quizzical, then said,
"Have a good one."
I ate a ham and onion sandwich at home and brushed my teeth.
then headed back to my office, not looking forward to the rest of the day. Helen followed me inside.
"You're off the case."
"What?"
I said. "I'm giving the investigation to Labiche."
I sat down behind my desk.
"What's going on?"
"Labiche interviewed Ms. D'Artes. She says you called her husband last night and arranged to meet him at the convenience store and bait shop by Bayou Benoit."
I stared at her, my scalp shrinking, a pain like a sliver of glass sliding through my bowels.
"You don't remember?" she said.
"No."
"Give me your cell phone."
I handed it to her. She opened it and began clicking through my calls with her thumb. She stared into my face and folded the phone. My heart was in my throat.
"It's clean," she said.
I swallowed.
"You could have deleted the call," she said.
"I didn't."
"How can you say what you did? Did you call the D'Artes house on your landline?"
"I don't remember doing that. I remember I was going to St. Martinville to sit on the bench under the Evangeline Oak."
"Do you know how silly that sounds?"
"It's the way I felt at the time." She picked up my right hand and looked at my knuckles. I pulled my hand away.
"I'm on your side," she said. "Even if you kill that man, I'm on your side. But don't lie to me."
"I don't know what I did, Helen. That's the truth. Does Ms. D'Artes have a cell phone or a landline?"
"A cell."
"Did Labiche check it?" She looked away from me.
"Not yet."
"Don't leave him on the case."
"Maybe he's a little hinky, but he came to us with a clean jacket.
Two black women filed complaints against him.
The same women have filed complaints against bill collectors and their estranged husbands.
They're probably telling the truth."
"Get used to seeing him around."
"Thanks for the hand up," I said.
"Piss off, Dave." She closed the door quietly behind her, sealing me in an airless vacuum, my sweat cold inside my shirt.
Cormac Watts called 3 hours later. "Hi, Dave. I wanted to update you on the D'Artes homicide."
"Spade Labiche is handling that."
"Oh.
What have you got?"
"Cause of death, blunt force trauma. Maybe he was stomped and kicked by someone wearing steel toes. There was a filter tip cigar stub lodged in his throat, plus a couple of teeth."
"That's it?"
"He went out hard. What else is there to say?" In AA, we respectfully refer to normal human beings as flatlanders or earth people. Drunks are space aliens and glow in the dark with phobias and hallucinations and paranoia, at least while they're on the grog. We also believe that blackouts are a violent neurological reaction to a chemical that an alcoholic's constitution cannot process, a bit like a firecracker exploding in the brain. As a rule, a person in a blackout has no more governance over himself than a car crashing through the rail on top of a 10-story parking garage. After work, I went to Cleet's cottage at the Tesh Motel and told him everything. He listened quietly, his big hands cupped on his knees. Through the window, I could see chickens pecking in the yard, a family cooking a pork roast on a spit among the oaks on the bayou, ducks wimpling the water. I felt as though I'd been trapped behind a wall of plexiglass while the rest of the world went about its business.
"You think you did it?" he said.
"Maybe."
"Did you fantasize about doing it when you weren't drinking?"
"No."
"When's the last time you ripped up somebody while you were drunk?"
"Never."
"That's my point. I don't buy this. Who's the last person you talked to before you blacked out?"
"A barmaid."
"At the joint on the bayou?"
"Her name was Babette."
"You walked home? You didn't drive?"
"Right."
"Then you decided to go to St. Martinville?"
"I was thinking about the way things used to be. I was thinking about my mother and father and fishing in a pirogue. It's just a foolish way I get sometimes."
"Listen, big man, I know your thoughts before you have them. Look at what you just told me. You were thinking about the best times in your life. You weren't thinking about killing a guy. You're not a killer, Dave. Neither of us is. We never dusted anybody who didn't deal the hand. You got that? I don't want to hear any Dr. Freud dog shit.
Freud was a genius, I said.
That's why he stuck all that coke up his nose.
I applied for a loan on a house.
You did what?
The banker said it wouldn't be a problem. If any collectors try to lean on you, let me know. I don't have a lot to lose right now.
I think Jimmy Nightingale is part of this, he said.
Why Nightingale?
Maybe he thinks you're on to him.
About what?
About everything. He's dirty. Maybe you know something about him he didn't want other people to hear.
I told him what you said about Kevin Penny. About Penny bringing dope and girls to Nightingale's home.
That would do it, Cleet said.
Killing someone? I don't believe that.
When are you going to wake up about that guy?
Cleet said. He went to the icebox and took out a quart bottle of beer and began chugging it, then paused.
Excuse me for doing this in front of you, but it's my feeding time. Plus, I can't stand listening to you protect a silver spoon con man like Nightingale.
I'd like to talk with Kevin Penny, I said. Where's he in custody?
He isn't. The guy he cut across the face decided he doesn't remember who mutilated him. Penny lives in a shithole south of Jennings.
I took a Dr. Pepper out of the icebox and sipped it while Cleet finished his beer. Outside I heard raindrops as fat as nickels clicking on the canvas top of Cleet's caddy. It was still raining when Cleet and I got off I-10 at Jennings and drove south to an Airstream trailer perched on blocks by a pond dark with sediment and coated with floating milk cartons and raw garbage. A dirt bike was parked in an open-sided shed. Cleet cut the lights and took his .38 white-handled snub nose from his shoulder holster and put it under the seat, then removed a sap and a pair of brass knuckles from the glove box and slipped them into his slacks.
Leave your piece, he said.
Why?
If it goes down and Penny gets his hand on a gun, he'll kill everybody in the room. When we have time, I'll show you a video of what he did to three black guys on the yard at Quentin.
He's not your ordinary pimp.
Penny is not your ordinary anything.
Cleet knocked on the door. I was wearing a raincoat and a rain hat pulled down on my eyes. A man with a complexion like mold on a lampshade opened it. His expression seemed to shape and reshape itself as though he couldn't make up his mind about what he was seeing. He wore a flannel shirt with the sleeves cut off, his cargo pants buttoned under the navel. The inside of the trailer was a wreck. What do you want?
A few minutes, Kev, Cleet said. This is my friend, Dave Robichaux.
His eyes seemed to burn into my face. Then his expression lightened.
You a cop?
Why do you think that? I said.
They walk like their underwear is too tight, or they got a suppository up their ass.
I treated you righteous, Kev, Cleet said. Lose the hostility.
So what do you want?
Jimmy Nightingale's cousin says she fired you. I didn't think that was right. She also said you were a yard man. That didn't ring right either. Help me out here.
His eyes went from Cleet to me, and then to Cleet again.
The bitch said that?
You got it.
Come in.
He closed the door behind us. Sit down. A half-eaten pizza lay in a delivery box on a breakfast table. A television set rested in the sink. A bed against the wall was layered with skin magazines. I tried to keep my expression neutral.
Why are you looking at me? He said.
Cleet showed me your sheet, I said. You were in three mainline joints, but you don't have any tats.
Pencil dicks need tats.
Want to find the biggest sissy on the yard? Check the guy with sleeves. What'd that bitch say?
Let's back up a little bit, Cleet said. Jimmy Nightingale told Dave he didn't know you.
He's a liar.
That's what I thought, Cleet said. I told Dave you were no yard man either.
I was a chauffeur.
You delivered dope and girls to Nightingale's house? I asked.
I'm supposed to answer that question? To a cop? What's with all this Nightingale stuff?
The Jeff Davis 8, I said.
Oh, boo-hoo time again, he said. Those whores got themselves killed.
How do you figure that? I said.
They're skanks. They're stupid. They go out on their own. Independence and the word whore don't go together.
They need a pimp, I said.
No, they need plastic surgery. Why you keep looking at me like that?
You're an interesting guy.
What's with this guy, Purcell?
Dave is all right, Kev.
Yeah? The stuff about the cousin?
She ain't Jimmy's cousin.
She's his sister or half-sister.
Let's stick to the subject, I said. In your opinion, who killed the 8 women?
They were in the life, man.
Why did Jimmy's secretary fire you, I said.
She came on to me. I told Jimmy, who cares about any of this?
There was a dull intensity in his eyes that's hard to describe or account for. You see it in recidivists or in lockdown units where the criminally insane are kept, although you are never sure they are actually insane. I like your accent, I said. Did you grow up in New Orleans?
I'm from New York.
Want to give us the name of the company bank account you were using as a drop, I said. But I had lost his attention.
What you got in your slacks, Purcell? A blackjack? You shitting me?
I always carry one. Take it easy.
I'm done talking. I'm going to finish my dinner.
You see Tony Squid around? Cleet asked.
At the aquarium.
Is Tony doing more than pour concrete for Jimmy Nightingale?
Cleet said.
Penny kicked open the door, letting in the rain.
Yous both get out.
Cleet told me you had a son, I said. I saw the alarm in Cleet's face.
What about him? Penny said.
What happened to him?
Nothing. He went to a home.
For irreparably damaged children? I said. He pared his thumbnail with the tine of a fork, then raised his eyes to mine. His lips curled as though he were preparing to speak, but he didn't utter a word. Somehow I felt I was gazing into the face of an old enemy. Cleet and I went down the wood steps into the rain. Cleet looked back over his shoulder. He took a breath.
He's got a hard-on for you, Dave. If you come out here again, carry a drop.
You'll cap a cop he's met one time?
He's got a brain like flypaper. He doesn't let go.
I feel like going back in there.
Let's have a burger and some coffee. Don't argue.
What'd he do to his son?
The kid is too scared to talk. Penny is supposed to get him back in 2 weeks.
He started the caddy. We drove slowly past the trailer and the pond, blanketed with floating trash.
The next morning, my first visitor in the office was Spade LaBiche. He looked energized, glowing with his new assignment, a notepad in his hand.
Got a second, Dave?
What's up? He sat down without being asked and peeled back his notebook.
I want you to know everything I'm doing. Maybe you can explain a couple of things as we go along.
Okay.
We pulled the phone records for calls made to the D'Artez number night before last. None were made from your cell or your landline, except one came in from a payphone at a filling station in St. Martinville. At just about the time Ms. D'Artez says her husband talked to you and said he'd meet you out by Bayou Benoit.
I didn't reply.
You had a snoot full?
He said. Who told you that?
Helen has to do her job, Robo.
Yeah, I was loaded.
I know what you mean, he said, writing in his notebook. So you were going to iron some things out with D'Artez about your wife's death?
I don't remember. He looked up at me.
Can you give me something to work with here?
So you can exclude me?
That's one way to look at it.
Do you have any witnesses?
I'm not supposed to discuss that. We've got to tow your truck in. Are you solid with that?
What for?
An anonymous tipster said he saw a beat-up blue truck slam the rear end of a black truck close to the convenience store. You told Helen you were headed to St. Martinville, so we got to have a look at your truck, Robo.
I don't know who gave you permission to give me a nickname, but I advise you to stop using it.
Ease up on the batter, Bubba.
Get out of my office. He flipped the notebook shut.
Have it your way.
I plan to. But I was all rhetoric. The truth is, the backs of my legs were shaking. The Electric Tiger
caught up with me at 11 Saturday night. That's what I used to call the heebie-jeebies. I first got them in Vietnam, along with the malaria I picked up in the Philippines. I came home with a hole in my chest and a punji scar like a flattened worm on my stomach and shrapnel in my hip and thigh that set off alarms when I went through metal sensors. The real damage I carried was one nobody saw. I'd hear the tiger padding around the house at 3 or 4 in the morning. Then he'd sniff his way into the bedroom, glowing so brightly that the air would glisten and warp and my eyes would sting. The strange phenomenon about alcoholic abstinence is that while you're laying off the hooch and working the program, your disease is doing push-ups and waiting for the day you slip. You can ease back into the dirty boogie or hit the floor running, but I promise you, the electric tiger, or your version of it, will come back with a roar. My truck was in the pound, but I had a rental parked in the driveway. I drove to a liquor store in Lafayette and bought a pint of vodka, a bottle of Collins Mix, a jar of cherries, a plastic cup, a small bag of crushed ice, and drove into Girard Park, next to the University of Louisiana campus, and got serious. The vodka went down cold and warm and sweet and hard as ice, all at the same time. When I closed my eyes, a lantern lit up the inside of my head, as if I'd punched a hypodermic loaded with morphine into my arm. It was an easy slide into the basement. The things I did next were not done in a blackout. I knew exactly what I was doing. I had put a sawed-off pool cue on the back seat before I left home, one that was weighted heavily at the base. I started the engine and got on I-10 and headed west. The speedometer maxed out. Chapter 8. Maybe Penny was sleeping one off, it's hard to say. I knotted a bandana around my face and set fire to the shed with dirt bike in it and tapped on the door and waited by the rear of the trailer. There was no reaction inside. A rain cloud burst directly overhead and the fire went out. I smashed on the door with my fist and was standing directly in front of it when Penny jerked it open. "What's the haps?" I said, swinging the pool cue at a 45-degree angle across his face. He stumbled backward, a hand pressed against one eye and the other eye bulging so his face looked like it had been sawed down the middle. "Hooda!" I stepped inside, pulled the door shut, and caught him with the weighted end of the cue on the ear. He crashed on the breakfast table, his mouth wide with either pain or surprise. I swung the cue on his neck and back and spine as though I were chopping wood. When he tried to stand, I shoved him onto the floor of the toilet cubicle. He was wearing only his socks and jockey shorts. Blood was leaking from his ear. "Why are you doing this? Who the fuck are you, man?" I kicked him in the face and dropped a full roll of toilet paper in the bowl and drove his head into the water and kept it there. I could feel him struggling, his forehead wedging the roll into the bottom of the commode, the water rising to his shoulders. I pushed down the handle to refill the bowl. Water was sloshing over the sides. My arm and shoulder were trembling with the pressure it took to keep him down. I began to count the seconds under my breath. 1 Mississippi, 2 Mississippi, 3 Mississippi. I stepped on his calf so he couldn't get purchase on the linoleum. 4 Mississippi, 5 Mississippi, 6 Mississippi. I shoved harder and saw bubbles the size and color of small oranges rise to the surface with a gurgling sound. 13 Mississippi, 14 Mississippi, 15 Mississippi. His arms had turned as flaccid as noodles and were flipping impotently at his sides. I pulled him dripping from the bowl and threw him onto the floor. He gasped and made a sound like a sheet of tin being ripped out of a roof. He gagged and cupped his mouth. "When your son comes home, you will act like a decent father. If you hurt him in any way, I'll be back." I stomped on his stomach. His mouth opened, and I shoved a bar of soap into it and mashed it down his throat with my shoe. I got into my rental and drove away. In the rearview mirror, I could see white smoke rising from the shed as though the fire I had started wanted to have another go at it. By 6 a.m., I was teetering on the edge of delirium tremens. By 7, they'd passed, and I was sound asleep in my skivvies face down on the sheets as though I had gone through a painless evisceration. Strangely, I felt at peace. I had no explanation. I went to Mass that evening in Lafayette and caught a meeting before returning to New Iberia. Helen was on my case early the next morning.
You told LaBiche to get out of your office?
I didn't know he was a snitch. He was trying to do his job, she said. He's a street rat.
I'm not going to put up with this, Dave.
Then don't. We were standing by the water cooler out in the hall.
Step inside my office, she said.
I tried to play the role of the gentleman and let her walk ahead of me.
Get inside, she said.
She slammed the door behind us.
Somebody pounded Kevin Penny into Hamburg. The sheriff and Jeff Davis says Penny believes it was you.
He believes it was me?
The assailant had a kerchief on his face.
Let's see. Penny has been in Quinton, Rayford, and Angola. He was in the AB, but his wife was half black. He's a pimp and a child abuser. Nobody besides a cop would want to hurt him, huh?
Where were you early Sunday morning?
Helen, I don't blame you because you have to treat me as a suspect in the D'Arthez homicide, but LaBiche is a bum. You shouldn't have put him in charge of the investigation.
Don't try to change the subject. Did you bust up Penny?
Somebody should have done it years ago. End of statement.
You're going to end up in prison.
Not because of Penny, I said. She touched at her nose and sniffed.
Maybe you're right about LaBiche.
Pardon? I'm not comfortable with LaBiche's history either. I never knew a guy in Vice who didn't get the wrong kind of rise out of his job. But he caught the case on his own hook, and to give it to somebody else because you don't like him would be obvious bias. I know.
You do?
You did the right thing.
You're a poor liar. She punched me in the chest hard. I'm mad at you, Dave.
At 5, I'd left the office and begun walking down the long driveway to East Main when I saw Levon Broussard turn out of the traffic and park his Jeep under the big live oak by the grotto devoted to the Mother of Jesus. He opened the car door and held up his hand.
I need to talk.
I'm on my way home, I said. Take a walk with me.
No, right here.
It's been a long day, I said.
It's fixing to get longer.
If it's business, I'll see you tomorrow at 8 a.m. Just then, Spade LaBiche came up to drive in an unmarked car. He leaned out the window.
Good news, Robichaux. A dent on your back bumper, but no paint from the D'Arthez vehicle. You're clean on the truck. It's at the pound. Catch!
He threw my keys at me. They landed in a puddle of muddy water.
Sorry,
he said, and drove away. I picked up the keys and wiped them with my handkerchief.
What was that about?
Levon said. Departmental politics. What did you want to tell me?
My wife has been raped.
The words didn't fit the scene. The wind was blowing through the branches overhead, the moss drifting in threads to the asphalt, votive candles flickering in the grotto. Say again?
She had a flat tire.
Jimmy Nightingale talked her into having a drink and got her drunk. He saw the expression in my eyes.
What?
People get themselves drunk, I said. Where is she?
At home.
Did she go to the hospital?
Our doctor came to the house. Why do you ask about a hospital?
Can she come to the department?
She doesn't want to.
I can understand that, Levon, but we don't do home calls. A female officer will interview her. The surroundings will be private. He looked around. I don't know what to do. I couldn't be sure if he was talking to himself or to me. Tell me what happened.
She was at the grocery last night. She came outside and saw she had a flat tire. Nightingale put her spare on. They went out to the highway and had a drink.
I could already see what a defense lawyer would do with Rowena's story. I'm sorry to hear about this, I said.
You don't believe her?
I didn't say that.
She trusts people when she shouldn't, he said. She thinks y'all won't believe her. She was doing work among the poor when I met her in Venezuela. She gave her paintings to the Indians, people no one cared about.
He waited for me to reply. I hate to handle sexual assault and child molestation cases because the victims seldom get justice, and that's just for starters. Adult victims are exposed to shame, embarrassment, and scorn. Often they are made to feel they warranted their fate. Defense attorneys tear them apart on the stand. Judges hand out probation to men who should be shot. Sometimes the perpetrator is given bail without the courts notifying the victim, and the victim ends up either dead or too frightened to testify. I've also known cops who take glee in a woman's degradation, and it's not coincidental that they work vice. I'm in the cook pot these days, Levon. I'll do what I can for y'all.
You're having some kind of trouble?
I'm a suspect in a homicide. His lips moved without sound. Yeah, it's a bit unusual, I said. He looked up and down the street.
You don't believe Rowena's account, do you?
I don't know all the circumstances.
She's never been unfaithful, he said.
The last statement was the kind no investigative cop ever wants to hear. Has Jimmy tried to contact you or your wife?
Jimmy?
I've known him most of my life.
Yes, and you introduced him to us, and now we know him too.
Sometimes you just have to walk away, and that's what I did.
I apologize, he said at my back.
The phone was ringing as I came through the front door. Hello, I said. It was Alifair. Cleet called. He says you're in trouble. I'll get out of it. He said you were in the bag.
No, I said. I mean, I'm not drinking now.
You stopped going to meetings?
I went last night.
What's this about the guy who hit Molly's car?
I was in a blackout. The guy was beaten to death out by Bayou Benoit. Maybe I did it.
The phone went silent. In the backyard, the sun and the smoke from meat fires in the park looked like spun gold in the trees. In my mind's eye, I saw Alifair at age 5, after I pulled her from a submerged plane piloted by a Marinole priest who was helping illegals escape the death squads in Central America. I thought about the wonderful life we'd had on the bayou. You never hurt anyone except in defense of yourself or someone else, she said. I'm flying into New Orleans tomorrow.
That's not necessary, Alfenheimer.
Don't call me that stupid name. How's your screenplay coming?
I'm writing it for people who think William Shakespeare was too wordy. How do you think it's coming?
What time does your flight come in?
Don't worry about it. I'll rent a car. Just hold tight till I get back to New Iberia.
I owned up at a meeting. I'm fine.
That's when people slip, isn't it? When they say they're fine?
Why did you drink, Dave?
The same reason as everyone who goes out. I wanted to.
The line was silent. I felt my heart stop.
Alifair?
You don't know how much it hurts when you say something like that.
My ear felt as though it had been stung by a wasp.
Victor's cafeteria on Main Street, right across from Cleet's office, opened at 6 a.m. every weekday. It was a grand place to eat and start the day, and usually crowded with business people and tourists and cops and parish politicians. If there was ever any better food on earth, I hadn't found it. Cleet and I went in at 7 on Tuesday, and Cleet loaded up with his healthy breakfast of 4 biscuits, scrambled eggs sprinkled with grated cheese, green onions, and bacon bits, a pork chop smothered in milk gravy, orange juice, a bowl of stewed tomatoes, and multiple cups of coffee. Helen was 2 tables from us. It was obvious she didn't want to acknowledge us.
What's wrong with her? Cleet said.
You didn't talk to anyone in Jefferson Davis Parish about an incident there, did you? He stopped eating.
Involving you?
Involving a graduate of Rayford in Angola and Quentin, we both know.
Something happened to Penny?
You could say that. He took his cell phone from his pocket and looked at the screen.
I've got 4 missed calls from the Jeff Davis Sheriff's Department.
Better answer them.
This isn't funny, Big Mon.
Penny didn't think so either. He started eating again, then put down his knife and fork and drank his coffee cup empty.
Let's go.
Where?
To the park.
How about your office?
You know how many times I've been bugged?
We walked to the drawbridge at Burke Street and crossed the bayou and went into City Park and sat in one of the picnic shelters by the water, a few feet from a row of camellia bushes, the petals still wet with dew. I told him everything.
You almost drowned him in the toilet?
Yep.
He'll come at you.
No, he won't. He's a gutless shit.
You're letting your past distort your thinking, Streak. The people who hurt you and me as kids are nothing compared to Penny.
They're all cut out of the same cloth.
My old man wasn't. He was just a drunk who figured himself a failure and didn't know where to put his anger.
People make peace with themselves in different ways, sometimes being more generous than they should. But you don't pull life preservers away from drowning people or deny an opiate or two to those who've taken up residence in the Garden of Gethsemane. Did you get enough to eat? I asked.
No.
I looked at my watch. We have time for a refill. Cleet had alluded to my childhood experience with a man named Mac. I didn't argue with him about the influence of Mac on my life. In fact, I don't think about Mac anymore. Eventually, he turned into a specter who drifted off into the mist, a dirty smudge not worth remembering. But there was never a man I hated as much, and I carried my hatred to Indochina and put his face on many an enemy soldier, none of whom deserved to be a surrogate for this evil man. For that reason alone, I did not willingly discuss my experience in the Orient, or the deeds I committed there, or the ribbons and wounds I brought home. Evil is evil, and you don't give the son of a bitch a second life. Chapter 9. At 10:41 a.m., Helen came into my office and looked out the window on the bayou. She had a manila folder clamped under her arm. "Rowena and Levon Broussard just left," she said. "Were they here for what I think?" I took her statement. "He says he talked with you late yesterday." "That's right." "What's your opinion?" she asked. "I didn't get many details. Alcohol seemed to be involved. No medical report. What did they tell you?" "She and Nightingale went to a lounge. They had four rounds of Manhattans. Then he wanted to show her his boat down at Sippermore Point. That's where he did it."
"What time of day?"
"About 10 p.m. When I didn't answer, she said, "Not good, huh?"
"I wonder if it's going to be prosecutable. She's married. It sounds like a tryst."
"I pushed her on that. She said she and her husband had a fight, and she used bad judgment."
"Where was her car?"
"At the supermarket."
"How'd she get back to it?"
"Nightingale drove her."
"Don't make that face."
"The defense will put a scarlet letter on her brow," I said. "We won't let that happen, though," Helen said.
"Will we?"
"We?"
She put the folder on my desk.
"No," I said. "I've got the video in my office. Let's get started."
"I'm not right for this," I said.
"How about you go on leave without pay instead?"
"I know all the involved parties, Helen."
"Like everybody in this building does it?"
I flipped open the folder and flipped it closed again. "What's her emotional state?"
"Like a vase somebody dropped on a concrete floor," she said.
"I never heard of Jimmy Nightingale abusing women."
"His casinos clean out the pockets of pensioners and poor people. He hangs with Bobby Earle. He's business partners with Tony the Nose. Remember when Tony and Dodoni Gicano used to stick people's hands in an aquarium full of piranhas?"
"Those were the good old days," I said.
"Time to kick butt and take names, Streak."
"Yes, ma'am."
I watched the video.
As in most interviews with sexual assault victims, the dialogue, the violation of privacy, and the demeanor of the victim were excruciating. For anyone who has a cavalier attitude about predation, he need only watch its influence on the victims in order to change his attitude. They cannot scrub the stain out of their skin.
Over and over again, the assault flickers like a sado-porn film on a screen inside their heads, sometimes for months, sometimes years. This goes on until they turn over the fate of their assailant to a power greater than they are. I've known 9 or 10 rapists who beat the system. I was convinced every one of them carried an incubus that eventually pissed on their graves. As I watched Rowena Broussard give her account on the video, I began to wonder if I was possessed of the male bias I never felt myself guilty of. She did not seem to be a person who could be lured easily into a vulnerable situation. She had lived in the Third World, where moral insanity, social cannibalism, and violence against the poor are part of the culture. Her paintings were testimony to her anger at dictatorial regimes and imperious personalities and people who sought dominion over others. I had seen her punch the heavy bag at Red's Health Club with the kind of power and dedication that makes adventurous men think twice. Jimmy Nightingale was not a large man. She said he put a pillowcase over her head and wedged his knee between her legs and worked off her undergarment with one hand. She said she cried out and told him to stop, even begged. I wanted to believe her. I hated cops and judges and prosecutors who sided with a rapist, and I've known many of them. There's no lower kind of individual on earth than a person who is sworn to serve, but who deliberately aids a molester and condemns the victim to a lifetime of resentment and self-mortification. But my uncertainty would not go away. I called Levon at home. I need a medical report from your physician, I said. You and Rowena have to give him permission to release it.
What good will that do?
It will tell us if there was bruising, or any number of other things.
Does that have to be public knowledge?
He asked. We can't make a case without it.
Hasn't she talked about it enough? I think there's an element of voyeurism in this.
Are you serious? I said.
What if there are only minor scratches and a small bruise? Dave, the real damage was done in ways I don't want to describe.
Y'all had better make up your minds.
All right. I'll call Dr. LeBlanc.
Thank you. I hung up without saying goodbye. I used a patrol woman to call Nightingale's home and find out where he was. I didn't want him prepared for the interview, nor did I want him coming to the department with an attorney. The patrol woman told the cousin, or half-sister, Emmeline Nightingale, that she wanted to contact Mr. Jimmy about a contribution to the Louisiana Police Benevolent Association, for which she actually solicited funds. I headed for his office in Morgan City. It was located not far from the big bridge that spanned the Atchafalaya River, with a view to the south of the shrimp boats at the docks and miles of emerald green marshland and islands of gum and willow trees. Jimmy was reading the newspaper, with one leg propped across the corner of his desk, when the secretary escorted me into his inner office. He put aside his newspaper and grinned as though God were in his heaven and all was right with the world. "My favorite flatfoot." I sat down. "I'm going to turn on my recorder, okay?"
"What for?"
"Sometimes I can't read my own handwriting."
"You've lost me."
"Rowena Broussard dropped a heavy dime on you, Jimmy. Rape, assault, and battery. Sodomy. Maybe false imprisonment."
"The heck you say?"
"She says y'all had some drinks and ended up on your boat at Sipramore Point."
"That's right. But that's all there was to it."
"You didn't attack her?"
"Attack her? I didn't do anything."
"You didn't have consensual sex?"
"I showed her my boat. That woman is nuts, Dave. I was pretty plowed myself. She could have put my lights out."
"She's pretty convincing."
"Send her out to Hollywood. She deserves an Academy Award. I can't believe this."
"I couldn't either, but for other reasons. In most rape cases, the accused immediately claims the act was done with consent. The issue then devolves into various claims about intoxication and the use of narcotics and muscle relaxants or inability on the victim's part to show sound judgment. I had never caught a sexual assault case involving adults in which the accused claimed to have done absolutely nothing."
Jimmy put a mint into his mouth and looked at me, never blinking. If you have dealt with liars, even pathological ones who pass polygraph tests, you know the signs to look for. The liar blinks just before the end of the lie, or he keeps his eyelids stitched to his brow. He folds his arms on his chest, subconsciously concealing his deception. The voice becomes warm, a bit saccharine. Sometimes there is an ethereal glow in the face. He repeats his statements unnecessarily and peppers his speech with adverbs and hyperbole. The first-person pronouns I, me, mine, and myself dominate his rhetoric. Conversely, the truth-teller is laconic and seems bored with the discussion, not caring whether you get it right or not. Nightingale showed none of the traditional characteristics of the liar, and I began to believe him. Then something very strange occurred. For just a second, I saw a glimmer in the corner of his eye, like a wet spot. His throat became ruddy. His lips parted slightly, as though he wanted to confide a secret to a trusted friend. "Did you want to tell me something, Jimmy?" The moment passed. His eyes were bright, his smile in place.
"I don't know what I could add."
"Want to come in and make a formal statement with your attorney present?"
"What good would that do?"
"Do it by the book. Show everybody you have nothing to hide," I replied.
Said the spider to the fly. "Where's this going, Dave?"
"That's up to the prosecutor's office."
"Rowena really said all those things?"
"I'm afraid so." I was a fool to take her to the boat. What's Levon got to say about all this?
What do you think?
I was hoping to put a movie deal together with him. I've got the connections to do it. I guess that's in the toilet, huh?
You're being accused of rape and sodomy and you're worried about a movie deal?
I thought Levon and I could make a grand film. He's a bit negative on Hollywood. I thought a down-home touch might be the key.
A down-home touch?
Outsiders don't understand us. Why do we have to depend on Hollywood to make movies about us?
His presumption and naivete would probably get him laughed out of Los Angeles or New York, but I couldn't help feeling sorry for him.
Thanks for your time, Jimmy. You're not planning to take a trip anywhere, are you?
No, I'm at your disposal.
I can't believe this is happening.
I thought about the beating death of T.J. D'Artes. I know the feeling.
Allifair pulled into the driveway late that afternoon. As I looked at her, I had to wonder again at the arbitrary nature of fate and how the most influential events in our lives are usually unexpected and unplanned. On a clear day out at Southwest Pass, I had heard a sputtering sound just before the twin-engine plane came in low on the water, a long black column of smoke stringing behind it. The pilot was gunning the engines, probably trying to reach Pecan Island, where he could pancake in the salt grass. But he'd hit the water and flipped, and the waves had washed over the fuselage, and the plane had gone down in the murk like a deflating yellow balloon. I still have nightmares in which I swim down to the wreck, my air tank almost empty, while clouds of sand rise from the plane's wings and the bat wings of stingrays flutter by me, and a little girl struggles to find an air bubble inside the cabin. My second wife, Annie, and I took her to a hospital and named her Allifair for my mother and began raising her in the Cajun culture in which I had grown up. She forgot her own language and the death squad that attacked her village and became an honor student and went to Reed College. The next stop was number one in her class at Stanford Law. But as with all parents, when I looked at Allifair, I saw the child and not the adult, as though she were incapable of growing older. I had a footlocker in the attic where I kept her Curious George and Baby Squanto Indian books, her Orca the Whale t-shirt, her Donald Duck hat with the quacking bill that we bought at Disneyland, and her pink tennis shoes embossed with left and right on the appropriate toes. The leaves were floating from the trees and blowing on the street when I went to greet her. She was tall and lithe and had long Indian black hair and brown eyes and an IQ that wasn't measurable. Only 2 people in 1 million have it.
I carried her things into a bedroom, which I dusted and cleaned every week and kept closed and never let anyone use, not even Cleet. After she put her things away, we went to the cemetery and placed flowers in a vase on Molly's grave. I never talked about Molly's death unless I had to, not even at the grave. I don't believe that acceptance of mortality is a situation you resolve by talking with others. The same with personal grief and mourning or loss of any kind. I remember the words of a black ex-junkie musician friend of mine who got clean in a lockdown unit where he beat his head to pulp against a steel wall. You deal with your own snakes or you don't, man. Sometimes you're the only cat in the cathedral. Ain't nobody else can do it for you. When we got home, I knew Alifair had read my thoughts.
You bottle up your feelings, Dave, she said. I think that's why you got drunk again.
Give it a rest, Alf.
You kept feeding your anger toward T.J. D'Artes. What do they say at meetings? You get drunk at somebody?
Something like that. I started taking food out of the icebox. She had just gone to the heart of the matter. Every time I tried to remember what had happened after I'd seen the headlights in my rearview mirror, I reached the same conclusion. And it is the same conclusion every alcoholic reaches after he comes off a bender, sick and trembling and terrified. I had done something my conscious mind refused to accept.
I haven't quite told you everything, I said. I went after a guy by the name of Kevin Penny. He's a violent man and a 3-time loser who's going to hurt his kid.
What'd you do?
It involved a swimming lesson in the toilet bowl.
Her eyes roved over my face.
What if he takes it out on his kid?
I called social services. They're going to make home calls, and so is Cleet.
Why do you have it in for this guy in particular?
I don't know. He bothers me. I came within a few seconds of drowning him. I wanted to do it. I poured a glass of milk and drank it. She watched me silently.
He isn't filing charges, she asked.
I had a bandana on my face.
Did somebody set you up on the D'Artes deal?
Evidently, I called his house the night he was killed. I asked him to meet me out by Bayou Benoit.
That's where he was killed?
Yes, I said. I showed him my hands. They were scabbed over, the knuckles still swollen.
Could you have punched a wall?
That's what I'd like to believe.
Cleek believes Fat Tony Nemo and Jimmy Nightingale and Levon Broussard may be mixed up in this, she said.
Cleek and I are always trying to find excuses for each other.
He says you had dinner with Nightingale and Levon.
Nightingale got a hold of a sword carried by Levon's great-grandfather in the Civil War and gave it to him. Nightingale wants to make a movie from one of Levon's novels, except Levon's wife and Nightingale hit it off a little too well.
Nightingale thinks he's going to produce a film with Levon? Where's he been?
What do you mean?
Everyone knows Levon hates Hollywood. He thinks they screwed up a couple of his adaptations. On CNN, he said, Hollywood is a potential gold mine for anthropologists, because it's the only culture in the world where educated and rich and powerful people have the mindset and manners of southern white trash.
That's not a bad line. I fixed avocado and tomato sandwiches for both of us, and we sat down at the breakfast table by the window. I glanced through the screen.
Look yonder.
What?
There's a coon on top of Tripod's hutch.
She leaned forward and peered through the screen.
I don't see him. He's right there, I said, pointing. His tail is hanging down the side of the hutch. I guess I need glasses.
Since when? I wondered. In the morning, I finally caught Levon Broussard's physician in his office. His name was Melvin LeBlanc. He had been a Navy corpsman during the first Iraqi war, and when he came home, he became a Quaker and enrolled in medical school at Tulane. He had the face of an ascetic, thinning, sandy hair,
and a stare that gave you the sense that he saw presences others did not. We were sitting in his office with the door closed.
"I'm not keen on this kind of stuff, Dave," he said.
"It's too personal?"
"I don't like to be used. That's what the defense does. That's what you guys do."
"Rowena and Levon gave you carte blanche to tell us everything, didn't they?" I said.
"I can tell you what I found or didn't find, but don't try to put words in my mouth."
"Was there evidence of forced penetration?" I said.
"Around the vagina, no. There was a bruise inside one thigh."
"A recent one?"
"Yes, sir."
"No abrasions?"
"Abrasions where?"
"Wherever they might be significant, Melvin."
"On the hip?"
"Scratches?"
"Correct."
"Perhaps consistent with someone tearing an undergarment from a victim's person?"
"I don't know. I didn't use the word victim either," he said.
"Did you do any swabs?"
"Ms. Broussard showered after she returned home. I recommended she go to the hospital and have a rape kit done. She refused."
"No trauma around the vagina?"
"None other than the bruise on the thigh."
"How about inside?"
"She didn't indicate any discomfort."
"This isn't coming together for me, Doc."
"That's your problem."
"Ms. Broussard says the assailant sodomized her."
"That's a relative word," he said.
"Not in this case."
"If you're asking about bite marks, there were none in the usual places."
"How about elsewhere?"
"On the shoulder."
"A bite mark?"
"What some call a hickey. It could have been put there before she went on the boat."
"Is that why you didn't mention it when I asked about abrasions?"
"Yes, sir."
"Any other reason?" I asked.
"There were only two people on that boat. One is lying, the other is not. That's about all I can tell you."
"You think Rowena Broussard would deliberately put herself through this kind of embarrassment? Would any woman, at least one who's sane?"
"Hell hath no fury," he said.
"Not a good metaphor."
"On the frontier, it was called cabin fever.
Levon has a helium balloon for a head. His art comes first.
He even tells people that at book signings. Some people want to save the world, but don't have time for their own family."
"What are you saying, Doc?"
"The human spirit is frail. People believe whatever they need to believe. I feel sorry for all of them."
That afternoon, Allifair was raking leaves in the backyard when she heard a vehicle come up the driveway and park under the porte cochere, as though the driver lived in the house. She walked around the side and saw a trim blonde man get out of a red Honda that looked brand new. He wore loafers and gray slacks and a long-sleeve purple shirt and a shiny black tie with a gold pin. His stomach was flat, his hair stiff with dressing of some kind, his hands big, the knuckles pronounced. He was holding a clipboard.
"Hi, I'm Detective Spade LaBiche. I work with Dave."
"He's not here right now," she said.
"Yeah, he caught the Broussard rape case, didn't he? Did he see the doc yet?"
"I don't know anything about that."
"I hope you don't mind me parking under your porte cochere. I had my car waxed."
"My car is parked on the street, so we don't need the space right now," she said.
The implication seemed to elude him.
"This is a nice spot," he said. "He puts you to work, the old man?"
"Beg your pardon?"
"I've read a couple of your books. I thought you'd be typing instead of piling leaves."
"Is there something I can help you with?"
"I'm excluding Dave in a situation that took place out by Bayou Benoit."
His accent was bottom of the bucket, New Orleans. "Why would Dave be here during work hours?" she said.
"He eats lunch at home some days, doesn't he?"
"It's after 2.
"I've never met a famous author. Where do you get your ideas?"
"I've never given it much thought. Do you want to leave a message?"
"Yeah, I could do it that way. You an ADA in Portland, right? You know the ropes."
"The ropes?"
"Whatever you want to call it. We're all on the same side."
He looked away at the bayou, a little dreamy. He scratched at a mosquito bite on his neck and glanced at his fingertips. The day was warm. When the wind changed, his odor touched her face, a mixture of detergent and perspiration.
We couldn't get any prints off the Dartez.